However crushed, disappointed, saddened, however difficult it was for him to bear up, he expressed no bitterness or envy, and no anger. Nor was anyone to feel sorry for him. "Be not concerned about me," he told Thomas. "I feel my shoulders relieved from the burden." As always, both Adamses were entirely candid with their children. To Thomas, Abigail wrote, "For myself and family I have few regrets. I shall be happier at Quincy." Only her private grief and public ingratitude could at times bear her down. "I lose my sleep often, and I find my spirits flag," she wrote to Cotton Tufts. "My mind and heart have been severely tried." The election had been closer than expected. Adams carried all of New England, but lost in New York, the South, and the West. The Republican victory in New York had been all-important and was due largely to extraordinary efforts by Aaron Burr in New York City. But it was not until Federalist strength in South Carolina proved insufficient to carry the state and its 8 electoral votes that the outcome was settled. In the final electoral count of all 16 states, Jefferson had 73 votes to Adams's 65. Pinckney had 63. But Burr had also wound up with 73 votes, and so was tied with Jefferson. The outcome, according to the Constitution, would have to be decided in the House of Representatives. What was surprising, and would largely be forgotten as time went on, was how well Adams had done. Despite the malicious attacks on him, the furor over the Alien and Sedition Acts, unpopular taxes, betrayals by his own cabinet, the disarray of the Federalists, and the final treachery of Hamilton, he had, in fact, come very close to winning in the electoral count. With a difference of only 250 votes in New York City, Adams would have won with an electoral count of 71-61. So, another of the ironies of 1800 was that Jefferson, the apostle of agrarian America who loathed cities, owed his ultimate political triumph to New York. Had the news of the peace agreement at Mortefontaine arrived a few weeks sooner, it too could very well have been decisive for Adams. Also, were it not for the fact that in the South, 3/5 of the slaves were counted in apportioning the electoral votes, Adams would have been reelected. To Adams, the outcome was proof of how potent party spirit and party organization had become. And the most prominent was Burr's campaign in New York. Washington, in his farewell address, had warned against disunion, permanent alliances with other nations, and the baneful effects of the spirit of party. Adams could rightly claim to have held to the ideals of union and neutrality, but his unrelenting independence, his desire to be a president above party, had cost him dearly. "How mighty is the spirit of party," he wrote to Elbridge Gerry. There was nothing unexpected about Jefferson's success, Adams thought, but Burr's good fortune surpassed all ordinary rules. All too plainly, times had changed. All the old patriots, all the splendid talents, the long experience, both Federalists and Anti-Federalists, must be subjected to the humiliation of seeing this dexterous gentleman, Burr, rise like a balloon, filled with uninflammable air over the heads. What an encouragement to party intrigue and corruption! In the last analysis, however, it was not Jefferson or the dexterous Burr who defeated Adams, so much as the Federalist War faction and the rampaging Hamilton. And none of this would have happened but for Adams's decision to send the second peace mission to France. It was his determination to find peace and check Hamilton that cost him the full support of the party and thus the election. Section 6. Tension and uncertainty over the Jefferson Burr deadlock increased by the day. Burr refused to step aside in deference to Jefferson and was said to be secretly bargaining with the Federalists in return for support when the issue went to the House. Hamilton, in an effort to play kingmaker at the last, was again in the thick of things. Given his intense dislike and distrust of both men, the choice was painful. But after consideration, he had decided on Jefferson. "Mr. Jefferson, though too revolutionary in his notions, is yet a lover of liberty and will be desirous of something like orderly government," Hamilton wrote in explanation. "Mr. Burr loves nothing but himself, thinks of nothing but his own aggrandizement. In the choice of evils, let them, the Federalists in Congress, take the least. Jefferson is, in my view, less dangerous than Burr." Adams, who could have applied influence behind the scenes, refused to say or do anything. Firm in his belief in the separation of powers, he saw it as a question for the legislature, in which he as president had no business, and he would stay far from it. It was said Adams so bitterly resented that Jefferson had bested him in the election that he refused to come to his aid, and that if the truth were known, he preferred Burr. But Adams expressed no enmity toward Jefferson, and in private correspondence, he and Abigail both said they preferred and expected Jefferson to be the one chosen. It was not that they had recovered their former affection for Jefferson, but they knew his ability. "All the splendid talents, the long experience," in Adams's words. Like Hamilton, they saw Jefferson as the less dangerous man. To Abigail, Burr was a figure risen upon stilts, with no thought to the good of the country. If there was a gleam of justice to the crisis, it was the dreadful pass Hamilton had come to. "Mr. Hamilton has carried his eggs to a fine market," Adams told William Tudor, using the old farmer's expression. "The very man, the very two men of all in the world that he was most jealous of are now placed above him." On January 1st, 1801, the Adamses held the first New Year's Day reception at the President's house. Several days later, they invited Jefferson to dine, one of several events that belie claims made then and later that Adams and Jefferson refused to speak. "Mr. Jefferson dines with us, and in a card reply to the President's invitation, he begs him to be assured of his homage and his high consideration," Abigail wrote Thomas in a letter dated January 3, 1801. Adams having made the overture, Jefferson had responded graciously. Whatever private feelings either harbored, civility prevailed. Other guests were included, and Abigail left an undated account of a conversation with Jefferson, who was seated beside her and professed not to know several members of Congress at the table. She said she knew them all. When he asked what she thought they mean to do about the election in the House, she said she did not know, that it was a subject she did not choose to converse upon, and then demonstrated that she could make him laugh. "I replied, 'I have heard of a clergyman who, upon some difficulty amongst his people, took a text from these words, "And they knew not what to do," from whence he drew this inference, that when a people were in such a situation, they do not know what to do, they should take great care that they do not do they know not what." At this he laughed out, and here ended the conversation. A month later, shortly before she planned to leave for Quincy ahead of the President, Jefferson would come to tea. "He made me a visit in order to take leave and wish me a good journey. It was more than I expected," she wrote. "Were it ever in his power to serve her or her family," he said, "nothing would give him more pleasure." Abigail had come to Washington with a heavy heart, as she told John Quincy in a long letter, and events since had provided little relief. My residence in this city has not served to endear the world to me. To private and domestic sorrow is added a prospect of public calamity for our country. What is before us, heaven only knows. The president, she was pleased to report, retains his health and his spirits beyond what you could imagine. They had no plans for the future, except to return to Quincy and take up the life they had both professed so often to want more than anything else, except that this time it would be to stay. To a suggestion from William Tudor that he and Tudor reunite as law partners, Adams replied in a letter of January 20th, "I must be Farmer John of Stonyfield and nothing more, I hope nothing less, for the rest of my life." That evening, when fire broke out next door in the Treasury building, Adams was immediately out the door and across the way to lend a hand. A newspaper described the event the next day. "The fire for some time threatened the most destructive effects, but through the exertions of the citizens, animated by the example of the President of the United States, who on this occasion fell into the ranks and aided in passing the buckets, was at length subdued." With little more than a month left to his term in office, Adams made one of the most important decisions of his presidency. Oliver Ellsworth had resigned as Chief Justice. To replace him, Adams first turned to his old friend John Jay, but when Jay declined, he chose John Marshall. According to Marshall's account, Adams and he were conversing in Adams's office at the president's house. "Who shall I nominate now?" Adams asked. When Marshall said he did not know, Adams turned and declared, "I believe I must nominate you." But it is probable that Adams knew exactly whom he would choose before Marshall ever entered the room. In many ways, the nomination was inevitable. Few men had so impressed Adams as Marshall, with his good sense and ability. Nor had anyone shown greater loyalty. He was Adams's kind of Federalist, and one who at 45, in the full vigor of middle age, as Adams said, could be expected to serve on the court for years to come. On January 31st, 1801, at the President's house, Adams signed Marshall's commission as Chief Justice, which the Senate confirmed without delay. In its far-reaching importance to the country, Adams's appointment of Marshall was second only to his nomination of George Washington to command the Continental Army 25 years before. Possibly the greatest Chief Justice in history, Marshall would serve on the court for another 34 years. As time ticked away in the Castle House, as he called it, Adams kept steadily at work, awaiting decisions in Congress on a judiciary bill that mattered greatly to him, the fate of the peace treaty, which mattered above all, and ultimately February 11th, when the electoral vote would be officially declared and the House would go into special session to resolve the Jefferson-Burr tie. On February 3rd, the Senate at last approved the convention of Montfontaine. No one was overly enthusiastic. As was once said of the Jay Treaty, it was thought to be about as good as could be expected under the circumstances. What was not known or even suspected was that Bonaparte, at the very time he had been dealing with the American Commission, was secretly negotiating a transfer of Louisiana from Spain to France. Dreading her long trip home, with so many horrid rivers to cross and such roads to traverse, Abigail put off her departure until after February 11th. "Today," she recorded on February 7th, "the judges and many others with the heads of departments dine with me for the last time." At the Capitol, Wednesday, February 11th, the Congress met in joint session. The certificates of the electors were duly opened by the Vice President, who declared the result, and the House went immediately into session to start balloting. But days passed with the House deadlocked, unable to reach a decision. As crowds gathered outside the capital, the tension grew extreme. "The crisis is momentous," reported the Washington Federalist. There was talk of desperate schemes to prevent the election, talk of civil war. Abigail decided she should wait no longer. Early in the morning of Friday, February 13th, she bid Adams goodbye and with her granddaughter, Susanna, set off by public stage through the wilderness to Baltimore, the first leg of her journey home. Her stay in the president's house was over, and she was to have little to say about it ever again. Years later, recalling the suspense of waiting for the House decision on the election, Jefferson would describe meeting with Adams on or about February 12th or 14th. "When the election between Burr and myself was kept in suspense by the Federalists," Jefferson would write to Benjamin Rush, "and they were mediating to place the president pro tempore of the Senate at the head of government, I called on Mr. Adams with a view to have this desperate measure prevented by his negative." According to Jefferson, Adams acted extremely displeased. "He grew warm in an instant and said with a vehemence he had not used toward me before, 'Sir, the event of the election is within your own power. You have only to say you will do justice to the public creditors, maintain the Navy and not disturb those holding office, and the government will instantly be put into your hands. We know it is the wish of the people it should be so.' 'Mr. Adams,' said I know not what part of my conduct in either public or private life can have authorized a doubt of my fidelity to the public engagements. I say, however, I will not come into the government by capitulation. I will not enter on it, but in perfect freedom to follow the dictates of my own judgment.' 'Then,' said he, 'things must take their course.' I turned the conversation to something else and soon took my leave. It was the first time in our lives we had ever parted with anything like dissatisfaction." There is nothing to contradict Jefferson's account or anything to verify it. Neither Adams nor his secretary, Billy Shaw, made a note of a visit by Jefferson or said anything of such an exchange in later years. Nor is there evidence that Adams ever discussed such terms with the Federalists in the House or took an interest in Federalist strategy. But it was also understandable that the Federalists wanted some assurance on where Jefferson stood, since he had made no statements on public issues. The suspense ended on Tuesday, February 17th, when, on the 36th ballot in the House, Jefferson was chosen president. One Federalist representative, James A. Byard of Delaware, decided at last to switch his vote. Later, Byard would say Jefferson had agreed to the three Federalist terms, but this Jefferson vehemently denied. The question of what actually happened would remain unresolved. "The Revolution of 1776 is now and for the first time arrived at its completion," proclaimed the Aurora. "Till now, the Republicans have indeed beaten the slaves of monarchy in the field of battle and driven the troops of the King of Great Britain from the shores of our country. But the secret enemies of the American Revolution, her internal, insidious, and indefatigable foes, have never till now been completely discomfited. This is the true period of the triumph of Republican principle." In the lame-duck Federalist Senate, meanwhile, an act expanding the federal judiciary, something that Adams had proposed more than a year earlier, was passed into law. The number of circuit courts was doubled to 6. 23 new judges were added. For Adams, who had so long championed a strong, independent judiciary as proper balance to the other two branches, it was a major improvement, and he proceeded at once to fill the new positions. For weeks, Adams had been exercising his presidential prerogative to fill government positions of all kinds, including some for friends and needy relatives. Scruples of the kind he had once preached to Mercy Warren concerning such appointments were considered no more. Colonel Smith was named Surveyor of the Port of New York. Joshua Johnson, the father-in-law of John Quincy, who had fled England to avoid his creditors, after his reputed wealth turned out to be a fiction, was made postmaster of the District of Columbia. But Adams's court appointments particularly were given careful consideration. There was no frenzied rush to name midnight judges, as portrayed by Jefferson and the Republican press. Most of the nominations for judges were made on February 20th, the rest completed by February 24th, more than a week in advance of the inauguration. That nearly all those selected were Federalists was no more surprising than the indignation of the president-elect. In fact, most all of the nominees were perfectly good choices, and the Republicans opposed hardly any of them. Abigail's nephew, William Cranch, who was nominated and approved for the Circuit Court of the District of Columbia, went on to have a distinguished 50-year career, both as a judge and a court reporter. Without any prompting or pressure, Adams also named Oliver Wolcott for the Second Circuit Court. Incredibly, Adams still trusted and liked Wolcott, never suspecting him of the treachery of others in the cabinet. Wolcott, for his part, often privately ridiculed the president for being abnormally suspicious. "I wish you much pleasure and more honor, and I doubt not you will contribute your full share to make justice run down our streets as a stream," Adams wrote. "My family joins in friendly regards to you and yours." Wolcott, for all he had done secretly to destroy Adams, was happy to accept the appointment. Abigail was not to expect much in the way of correspondence from him, Adams told her. "My time will be all taken up. I pray you to continue to write me." He would be entertaining a delegation of Indians that evening, February 16, 1801, his last official dinner, and was glad to say he was sleeping better for having the shutters open. Among Adams's final acts as president, and undoubtedly with strong encouragement from Abigail, was to recall John Quincy from his diplomatic service abroad. Among the last letters he wrote as time ran out was a considerate reminder to Jefferson that he need not purchase horses or carriage, since those in the stable at the president's house were the property of the United States and would therefore remain behind. On Inauguration Day, Wednesday, March 4th, John Adams made his exit from the president's house in the Capitol at 4 in the morning, traveling by public stage under clear skies lit by a quarter moon. He departed 8 hours before Thomas Jefferson took the oath of office at the Capitol, and even more inconspicuously than he had arrived, rolling through empty streets past darkened houses, and again with Billy Shaw and John Breisler as his companions. To his political rivals and enemies, Adams's pre-dawn departure was another ill-advised act of a petulant old man. But admirers, too, expressed disappointment. A correspondent for the Massachusetts Spy observed in a letter from Washington that numbers of Adams's friends wished he had not departed so abruptly. "Sensible, moderate men of both parties would have been pleased had he tarried until after the installation of his successor. It certainly would have had good effect." By his presence at the ceremony, Adams could have set an example of grace in defeat, while at the same time paying homage to a system whereby power, according to a written constitution, is transferred peacefully. After so vicious a contest for the highest office, with party hatred so near to igniting in violence, a peaceful transfer of power seemed little short of a miracle. If ever a system was proven to work under extremely adverse circumstances, it was at this inauguration of 1801, and it is regrettable that Adams was not present. It would also have been more politic to have expressed confidence in his successor, but such expressions were not Adams's way if he did not mean them. No president having ever been defeated for re-election until then, there was no tradition of a defeated president appearing at the installation of the winner. It is also quite possible that Adams was not invited to attend or made to feel he would be welcome. When it was rumored, for example, that Adams might deliver a valedictory to Congress, the Aurora had questioned how possibly the Duke of Braintree could ever consider appearing before a body in which his former friends are his enemies and his former opponents the only persons who pity him. Adams, said the Aurora, was a man who had been cast out by God like polluted water out at the back door. May he return in safety to Braintree, that Mrs. Adams may wash his befuddled brains clear. Perhaps, given what Adams had been through at the hands of the Republicans and a number of Federalists still in Congress, those who had done all they could to overthrow him, he simply could not face being made a spectacle of their triumph. Also, Adams's departure was no sudden dark-of-the-night impulse. It had been planned more than a week in advance, as is clear from the correspondence of Billy Shaw, and there was no secret about it. To get to Baltimore in a day, one had to take the early stage, and the early stage departed at 4 in the morning. Adams himself never explained why he did not stay for Jefferson's inauguration, but then it seems he was never asked. "We are all Republicans, we are all Federalists," Jefferson said famously in his inaugural address before a full Senate chamber, his voice so soft many had difficulty hearing him. A passing tribute to Washington was made before he finished, but of Adams he said nothing. To the victorious Republicans, and to generations of historians, the thought of the tall Jefferson with his air of youth at 57, assuming the presidency in the new capital at the start of the new century, his eye on the future, would stand in vivid contrast to a downcast, bitter John Adams, old and toothless at 65, on his morning flight to Baltimore. Downcast, bitter, Adams may have been. But there is no evidence to support such a description. Adams loved the start of a new day, loved being on the move. Conceivably, he felt immense relief to be homeward bound, free, finally, of his burdens, his conscience neat and easy, as he would say. No one will ever know. But it is perfectly possible that as the sun rose higher that cloudless morning, Adams felt contentment of a kind he had not known for years. Once he got over the fact that traveling with him on the same stage, as chance would have it, was Theodore Sedgwick. Like two warring boys who are made to sit in the same room until they get along, they would ride together all the way to Massachusetts. Section 7. Whatever Adams's state of mind, he was leaving his successor a nation with its coffers full, as he wrote, and with fair prospects of peace with all the world smiling in its face, its commerce flourishing, its navy glorious, its agriculture uncommonly productive and lucrative. In turbulent, dangerous times, he had held to a remarkably steady course. He had shown that a strong defense and a desire for peace were not mutually exclusive, but compatible, and greatly in the national interest. The new Navy was an outstanding achievement. In less than 2 years, it had grown from almost nothing to 50 ships, including the frigates United States, Constitution, and Constellation, and over 5,000 officers and seamen, and this bore heavily on the outcome of the negotiations with France. Indeed, Adams's insistence on American naval strength proved decisive in achieving peace with France in 1800. Further, by undercutting Hamilton and making his army useless, he may have saved the country from militarism. In his 4 years as president, there had been no scandal or corruption. If he was less than outstanding as an administrator, if he had too readily gone along with the Alien and Sedition Acts and was slow to see deceit within his own cabinet, He had managed, nonetheless, to cope with a divided country and a divided party, and in the end achieved a rare level of statesmanship. To his everlasting credit, at the risk of his career, reputation, and his hold on the presidency, he chose not to go to war when that would have been highly popular and politically advantageous in the short run. As a result, the country was spared what would almost certainly have been a disastrous mistake. In much the way he had rushed out in the night to help fight fires in Philadelphia and Washington, he had done his all to put out the fire of war, to the immeasurable benefit of the American people, and with no loss of honor or prestige to the nation. It was a brave, heroic performance. Adams understood clearly the importance of what he had accomplished. To his dying day, he would be proudest of all of having achieved peace. As he would write to a friend, "I desire no other inscription over my gravestone than, 'Here lies John Adams, who took upon himself the responsibility of peace with France in the year 1800. In the brief spell of goodwill that followed Adams's inaugural address in 1797, Benjamin Bache had reminded the country that the new president was a man of incorruptible integrity, dignity, exceptional resources of mind, and high purpose. He declares himself the friend of France and of peace, the admirer of republicanism, the enemy of party. How characteristic of a patriot!" The same could have been said at the conclusion of Adams's presidency, no less than at the beginning. Subjected to some of the most malicious attacks ever endured by a president, beset by personal disloyalty and political betrayal, suffering the loss of his mother, the near death of his wife, the death of a son, tormented by physical ailments, he had more than weathered the storm. His bedrock integrity, his spirit of independence, his devotion to country, his marriage, his humor, and a great underlying love of life were all still very much intact. Chapter 11. Rejoice Evermore. This phrase, "Rejoice evermore," shall never be out of my heart, memory, or mouth again as long as I live, if I can help it. John Adams. Section 1. "The only question remaining with me is, what shall I do with myself?" Adams had written earlier to Cotton Tufts. "Something I must do, or ennui will rain upon me in buckets." He could go each morning and evening to fodder his cattle, he supposed, or take noontime walks to Penn's Hill, or potter among his fruit trees and cucumbers. But what then? If he had money enough to spend on his farms, he might keep busier. But where was the money to come from? Talk of himself as Farmer John of Stonyfield came easily. The reality would require adjustments. He worried about the effect on mind and body of slowing to a standstill. His constitution, he was sure, would be put to a severe test after a life of journeys and distant voyages. "Stillness may shake my old frame," he observed to another friend. "Rapid motion ought not be succeeded by sudden rest." He sensed he had little time left. "The day is far spent with us all," he would tell Mercy Warren. "It cannot be long before we must exchange this theater for some other." He only hoped it would be one with no politics. He and Abigail both had had enough of politics. "No more elective office for me," she had written with absolute certainty. But neither would ever lose interest in politics. For Abigail, it was not just that the long journey of public life was ended, but that their capacity to do good was to be so greatly curtailed, as she had written before leaving Washington. As it was, She and Adams had 10 days of forced seclusion in which to ponder such concerns, starting almost the moment Adams arrived at Quincy on the evening of March 18, 1801. He was no sooner in the door than a wild northeaster struck, a storm of a kind such as they had not seen in years. Black skies, violent winds, and a flood of rain kept on day after day, no one budging from the house. Somehow the mail got through, bringing a pointedly formal note of one sentence from the president dated March 8th. Thomas Jefferson presents his respects to Mr. Adams and encloses him a letter which came to his hands last night. On reading what is written within the cover, he concluded it to be a private letter, and without opening a single paper within it, folded it up, and now has the honor to enclose it to Mr. Adams with the homage of his high consideration and respect. Adams's reply, written on March 24th, the fifth day of the storm, was one of the few times he ever acknowledged his suffering over the death of Charles, but suggests also that Jefferson may never have offered a word of sympathy to him. "Had you read the papers enclosed," Adams wrote, "they might have given you a moment of melancholy or at least of sympathy with a mourning father. They relate wholly to the funeral of a son who was once the delight of my eyes and a darling of my heart, cut off in the flower of his days, amidst very flattering prospects, by causes which have been the greatest grief of my heart and the deepest affliction of my life." In closing, Adams said he saw nothing to obscure your prospect of a quiet and prosperous administration, which I heartily wish you. Jefferson did not respond, however. Adams's letter was the last there would be between them for 11 years. The violence and duration of the storm appears to have left Adams in better spirits once it passed. "It was," he wrote to Benjamin Stoddart, "so old-fashioned a storm that I begin to hope that nature is returning to her old good nature and good humor, and is substituting fermentations in the elements for revolutions in the moral, intellectual, and political world." Complaining was not the Adams's mode. The adjustments were more difficult than they would concede. The humiliation that defeat and popular rejection had inflicted on them, the death of Charles and now sudden total seclusion, took a heavy toll. In some circles, they knew, they were openly despised. In others, they were now considered irrelevant. Worst, perhaps, was the sense that no one any longer cared about them one way or the other. In the year prior to March 4th, letters to President Adams numbered in the thousands. In the year that followed, Citizen Adams received fewer than 100. Once, while president, he had written to Abigail, "We cannot go back, we must stand our ground as long as we can." In the years following the presidency, it was resolve of a kind they had to summon more often than they admitted. When members of the Massachusetts legislature came to Quincy to present Adams with a tribute to his devoted service to his country, he was moved to tears. Feelings of dejection and bitterness would come and go for a long time. Nearly 6 months after the return to Quincy, in a letter to Billy Shaw, Adams would allow that if he had it to do over again, he would have been a shoemaker. His own father, the man he admired above all, had been a shoemaker. Joseph Bass, the young neighbor who had ridden with Adams to Philadelphia in the winter of 1776, was a shoemaker and a familiar figure still in Quincy, as well-liked and respected as ever. Long before, on his rounds of Boston as a young lawyer, Adams had often heard a man with a fine voice singing behind the door of an obscure house. One day, curious to know who this cheerful mortal might be, he had knocked at the door to find a poor shoemaker with a large family living in a single room. "Did he find it hard getting by?" Adams had asked. "Sometimes," the man said. Adams ordered a pair of shoes. "I had scarcely got out the door before he began to sing again like a nightingale," Adams remembered. "Which was the greatest philosopher? Epictetus or this shoemaker? He would ask when telling the story. Epictetus, the Greek Stoic philosopher, had said, among other things, "It is difficulties that show what men are." With the revival of spring on the farm, with fruit trees in flower and warmer days steadily lengthening, familiar roles and routines resumed. Abigail, in a letter to Colonel Smith, asked that he tell Nabby, "I have commenced my operation of dairy woman, and she might see me at 5 o'clock in the morning skimming my milk." To Catherine Johnson, John Quincy's mother-in-law, she described how the beauties of her garden, "From the window at which I write, the full bloom of the pear, the apple, the plum, and peach, helped her forget the past and rejoice. Envy nips not their buds, calumny destroys not their fruits, nor does ingratitude tarnish their colors." "Your father," she told Thomas, "appears to enjoy tranquility and a freedom of care which he has never before experienced. His books and farm occupy his attention." Adams professed to be perfectly content in his new employment, but how long this tranquility would continue, he could not honestly say. "Men are weak," he added in a letter to William Cranch. "No man can answer for himself." He wrote but few letters, and these mostly to friends who had written to wish him well in retirement. But then, as he said, he did not have a great deal to write about, except for how his corn was growing, or how much wall I lay up every day. Only occasionally, in what he wrote, did he reflect on the national or world scene. There was no use trying to predict what Bonaparte might do, because Bonaparte was not like any conqueror of the past, he offered at one point in a letter to Thomas. "Everything I read only serves to confirm me in the opinion of the absolute necessity of our keeping aloof from all European powers and influences, and that a navy is the only arm by which it can be accomplished." Jefferson, he noted, had lately said some very strong things about the navy, and Adams felt irresistibly inclined to agree with him. But there was a problem with Jefferson, he told Thomas. "The only misfortune of it is that Mr. Jefferson's sayings are never well digested, often extravagant, and never consistently pursued. He has not a clear head, and never pursues any question through. His ambition and his cunning are the only steady qualities in him. His imagination and ambition are too strong for his reason." In mid-June came welcome news from John Quincy. After several miscarriages and a difficult pregnancy, Louisa Catherine had given birth to a baby boy on April 12th in Berlin. They would be departing for home as soon as mother and child were strong enough. Abigail worried about how well John Quincy might cope with his added burdens. "I pray God send him a safe and fortunate passage to his native land with his poor, weak, and feeble wife and baby," she wrote to Thomas. When, a few weeks later, she learned that the baby had been named George Washington Adams rather than John, she was not pleased. "I am sure your brother had not any intention of wounding the feelings of his father, but I see he has done it." After 7 years abroad, John Quincy would have to begin all over again in the law in Boston. In a profession he never loved, in a place which promises him no great harvest, Abigail wrote sympathetically. It was a humiliating prospect. Yet she saw no other choice for him. So long as the Republicans were in power, the post of honor would be in private pursuits. Adams, meantime, was busy in his hayfields, bringing in the biggest crop ever. Where once his yield had been 6 tons on the same acreage, it was now 30, to his immense delight. The Adams domain comprised in all 3 farms. In addition to the main house, there were the 2 old houses by Penn's Hill where Adams had been born and where he and Abigail had raised their family. In total, by now, there were more than 600 acres of fields, woods, and salt marsh, and as usual in summer, the work required hired help. Adams loved joining in the work as much as ever, for the exercise and pure air, the companionship of men he had known and worked with for years, and the pride he took in seeing things done just so. But it all had to be taken with utmost seriousness. Stonyfield was no gentleman's farm, and he no gentleman farmer. The farm that had sustained the Adamses and their family through the lean years of the Revolution would have to sustain them again. They could expect no additional income. And while the farm had expanded over the years, so had the family. The Adams household was more crowded now than it had ever been, and would remain so. John and Abigail had taken Charles's wife Sally and her two daughters in to live with them, and this, in addition to Louisa Smith, made six. Nabby and her four children also moved in for the summer, which brought the total to 11, not counting servants or visiting cousins or friends, of which there were often two or three. At times, there were 20 people or more beneath their roof. In addition, since the return from Washington, Abigail had acquired a Newfoundland puppy, which she named Juno. John Quincy, Louisa Catherine, and their infant son arrived at Philadelphia on the ship America on September 4th, 1801. Her health, though yet very infirm, is better than we could have expected, John Quincy said of Louisa Catherine in a letter to his father. And your grandson is as hearty as any sailor of his age that ever crossed the ocean. They were staying with Thomas and had so much to talk about there was little time for anything else. The day the letter reached Quincy, Adams wrote, was one of the happiest of his life. I hope you will consider my house as your home for yourself, your lady, and son, as well as your servants. We can accommodate you all as well as destiny intends that you and I ought to be accommodated, at least until you have time to deliberate on your future arrangements. After a rest in Philadelphia, Louisa Catherine and the baby traveled to Washington to see her parents, while John Quincy set off for Massachusetts. The only difference he saw in his brother, Thomas reported to his parents, was a sort of fatherly look. Also, Thomas informed them, he has no propensity to engage in a political career. John Quincy wrote of his reunion with his parents as a moment of inexpressible delight. Arriving on September 21st, he found his father in good health and spirits. His mother, though very ill, was fast on the mend. Both mother and father, he assured Louisa Catherine, were waiting to receive her with most cordial affection. In a few weeks, having purchased a house in Boston, he left for Washington to bring her and the baby home. Any apprehensions he may have had about Louisa Catherine's first meeting with his family he kept to himself. According to what she wrote long afterward, Louisa Catherine arrived at Quincy and almost immediately decided she liked nothing about it or its quaint ways. It was the Thanksgiving season, the days chill, and she was feeling miserably ill and depressed. Family and friends were gathered to look her over. Raised in France and London, well-read, well-mannered, and well-spoken with an English accent, she found herself being gazed at as a curiosity, a fine lady. "Only the old gentleman took a fancy to me," she would write, remembering Adams's warmth and interest in her. Otherwise, she felt hopelessly out of place. Quincy? What shall I say of my impressions of Quincy? Had I stepped into Noah's Ark, I do not think I could have been more utterly astonished. Dr. Tufts, Mr. Cranch, old Uncle Peter. It was lucky for me that I was so much depressed and so ill, or I should certainly have given mortal offense. Even the church, its form, its snuffling through the nose, the singers, the dressing and dinner hours, were all novelties to me, and the ceremonious parties, the manners, and the hours of meeting 4:30 were equally astonishing to me. Thomas, who had been quite taken with Louisa Catherine, wrote to his mother of her sprightliness and vivacity. "Even when in only tolerable health," Thomas said, "her spirits are abundant." But she was not in tolerable health at Quincy, and her spirits were far from abundant. As she herself recalled, she was cold and reserved, and seldom spoke, which was deemed pride. Everyone wanted to please her, and at meals particularly, but the more she was fussed over, the more she resented it. "I had a separate dish set by me, of which no one was to partake, and every delicate preserve was brought out to treat me with in the kindest manner. And though I felt very grateful, it appeared so strongly to stamp me with unfitness that often I would not eat my delicacy, and thus gave offense. Mrs. Adams was too kind. Louisa Smith was jealous to excess, and the first day that I arrived left the table crying and sobbing, and could not be induced to eat any dinner." Abigail's impressions, written at the time, express concern rather than disapproval. The young woman seemed so terribly frail and suffered such a racking cough that Abigail feared for her life. "Her frame is so slender and her constitution so delicate that I have many fears that she will be of short duration." Except for the old gentleman's obvious approval of Louisa Catherine, it was not an auspicious beginning. Abigail found it impossible to ignore the weight of worry that had been added to John Quincy's brow. Louisa Catherine was 26 years old, John Quincy 34. In the time he had been away, his hair had greatly thinned, which made him look older, and he did indeed have a serious expression most of the time. With age, he was looking more like his father than he had, and there was no mistaking his extraordinary intelligence. But he was less ardent, less spontaneous than his father. He had little of Adams's passion for life or his humor. By Christmas, the young family had moved into their new home in Boston. John Quincy worried over expenses, worried that his parents might find themselves with too little money. Finding it difficult to get started again in the law, feeling like a stranger, and bored with what work he had, he toyed with the thought of giving it up and striking out for a life of rustic independence in the wilds of upstate New York, an idea encouraged by his brother-in-law Colonel Smith, and that appealed at once to Brother Thomas. "I am your man for a new country," Thomas affirmed, convinced that his own legal career in Philadelphia was going nowhere. That neither of them was the least prepared or suited for such a venture seems not to have occurred to them. But the impulse passed as John Quincy began to feel more at home in Boston and acquired a circle of friends. And whatever prior aversion to politics he had had, or that his parents may have expressed, he was very soon involved. "Walked in the mall just before night," he recorded in his diary on January 28, 1802. "I feel a strong temptation and have great provocation to plunge into political controversy." Then he wrote, "A politician in this country must be the man of a party. I would fain be the man of my whole country." In April 1802, less than 4 months after settling in the city, John Quincy was elected to the Massachusetts Senate. The following November, he ran as a Federalist candidate for Congress and lost, but by less than 100 votes. He had become a rising star. In February 1803, at age 35, John Quincy Adams was elected a United States Senator, a victory made all the sweeter by the fact that his opponent was Timothy Pickering. In the meantime, he could not have been a more dutiful son, riding out to Quincy to be with his parents nearly every weekend. He kept his father supplied with books and encouraged him to undertake an autobiography, which Adams, with some reluctance, began in October 1802 with Part 1, titled John Adams. But it was the following spring in 1803, just after he had been elected to the Senate, that John Quincy came to the rescue of his father and mother as no one else could have. Partly on his advice, most of what John and Abigail had managed to save over the years, some $13,000, had been invested with the London banking house of Bird, Savage, and Bird, bankers for the United States Treasury. It had seemed an entirely prudent step. But in 1803, the house of Bird, Savage, and Bird collapsed, leaving the Adamses on the brink of ruin. At once, John Quincy stepped in to save them. "The error of judgment was mine," he wrote, "and therefore I shall not refuse to share in the suffering." By selling his house in Boston, drawing on his own savings, and borrowing, he was able to proceed slowly to buy up his parents' property, ultimately paying them what they had lost while they retained title to the land for life. To their joy, he also announced that he would move to Quincy with his family, which by the summer of 1803 included a newborn second son, this one named John Adams. The plan was to live in the house where John Quincy had been born, but by September, he and his family were off to Washington. Section 2. To the great surprise of those who had predicted nothing but dire consequences should Thomas Jefferson ever rise to the presidency, the advent of Jefferson in the president's house turned out to be far from a radical upheaval or a second revolution, as he claimed. Not surprisingly, Jefferson made Madison the Secretary of State and chose Albert Gallatin as Secretary of the Treasury. He did away with presidential levies, something Adams had wanted to do but felt obliged to continue. Under the new system, Jefferson received the public only twice a year at the president's house, New Year's Day and the 4th of July. He entertained frequently, but preferred small, elegant dinners, which were part of his way of carrying on the process of government. Rather than going to the Capitol to speak before Congress, he submitted his annual message in writing. Among his first decisions after taking office was to release from jail those sentenced for violating the Sedition Act. And with the avid support of the Republican majority in Congress, he did away with Adams's Judiciary Act and the new circuit courts. Further, Jefferson abolished the old whiskey tax and began cutting back on the Navy, halting shipbuilding and selling off ships already built, while at the same time, ironically, starting to deal effectively with the Barbary pirates. Yet the first year and more passed with surprisingly little commotion or sensation, until the first weeks of September 1802, shortly before John Quincy declared himself a candidate for Congress. It was then, in the second year of Jefferson's new administration, that the rumor, hitherto only whispered, of a liaison between Jefferson and a slave woman broke into print. What made it especially sensational was that the source of the allegation was his own former ally and unrelenting scourge of John Adams, the notorious James Callender. As Abigail would later tell Jefferson bluntly, it was as though the serpent he had cherished and warmed had turned and bit the hand that nourished him. The slave woman, as the Adamses and the country learned, was Sally Hemings, who 15 years before, at age 14, had arrived with little Polly Jefferson at the house on Grosvenor Square in London, and Abigail had judged her too immature to look after the child. Callender, having served his sentence for violating the Sedition Act, was out of jail by the time Jefferson took office. But unable to pay the fine imposed by the court, he had appealed to Jefferson for help, asking also that he be made postmaster in Richmond. Feeling that Jefferson owed him as much and more, Callender went to Washington to see Madison, and in the course of the meeting implied that if denied his requests, he might have things to say. Madison warned Jefferson, who immediately, on May 28, 1801, had his secretary, Meriwether Lewis, give Callender $50. Furious at Jefferson's parsimony, Callender switched sides to become the editor of a new Federalist paper in Richmond, The Recorder. In the summer that followed, writing in the recorder, Callender revealed that Jefferson, while vice president, had secretly subsidized and encouraged him as he broke the Hamilton-Reynolds scandal and did all he could to defame John Adams. For proof, Callender quoted several of Jefferson's letters to him. "I am really mortified at the base ingratitude of Callender," Jefferson wrote to James Monroe on July 14th. His concern, Jefferson said, was that his own mere motives of charity might be misunderstood. When the Republican press attacked Callender for his apostasy, ingratitude, cowardice, lies, venality, and constitutional malignity, Callender struck back in the recorder on September 1, 1802, under the title, "The President Again." "It is well known that the man whom it delighteth the people to honor keeps and for many years has kept a concubine, one of his slaves. Her name is Sally. By this wench, Sally, our president has had several children. There is not an individual in the neighborhood of Charlottesville who does not believe the story, and not a few who know it. The African Venus is said to officiate as housekeeper at Monticello." In subsequent articles, Callender reported that Sally Hemings had five children, that she had been in France with Jefferson, and claimed that now, with the truth out, Jefferson could expect certain defeat in the next election. The stories spread rapidly, appearing in the Federalist Press, the New York Evening Post, the Washington Federalist, the Gazette of the United States, and in Boston in the Gazette and the Columbian Sentinel, papers read by the Adamses. A cartoon published at Newburyport, titled "A Philosophic Cock," pictured Jefferson as a rooster strutting with his dark hen Sally. In October, the Boston Gazette ran the words to a song of several stanzas, supposed to have been written by the sage of Monticello, to be sung to the tune of "Yankee Doodle." "Of all the damsels on the green, on mountain or in valley, alas, so luscious ne'er was seen as Monticellian Sally. Yankee Doodle, who's the noodle? What wife were half so handy to breed a flock of slaves for stock? A blackamoor's a dandy." The Aurora and the rest of the Republican press remained conspicuously silent on the subject, taking their lead from the president. Jefferson, who made it a rule of life not to respond to newspaper attacks, neither denounced Callender nor denied or admitted a connection with Sally Hemings. That Callender was a malicious scoundrel was undeniable, and more than enough for many people to dismiss his charges out of hand. There was no evidence, and further, the story seemed preposterously out of character for a man of such refinement and intellect, not to say for the President of the United States. To Republicans, it was but one more act of Federalist villainy. What was actually known of Monticellian Sally amounted to little, and for all the rumors, all that was written then and later, relatively little would ever be known. She was the daughter of a slave woman named Betty Hemings, who had belonged to Jefferson's father-in-law, John Wales, who reputedly was Sally's father. If true, this made her the half-sister of Jefferson's wife, Martha. And it was said that she resembled Martha Jefferson and was fair-skinned and decidedly good-looking. An aged former Monticello slave, Isaac Jefferson, would later remember Sally as "very handsome, long, straight hair down her back." To what degree she had benefited from her years in France, whether she could read or write, or anything about her disposition or abilities, are matters of speculation. It was true, as Callender reported, that by 1802 Sally had given birth to five children, but two had died in infancy. According to surviving records, she had seven children, all born at Monticello, two of whom came later, Madison in 1805 and Easton in 1808. From Jefferson's own records, it is clear that he was at home at Monticello at least 9 months before the birth of each of her children, and that she never conceived when he was not there. Her children were all light-skinned, and several, as gossip then, looked astonishingly like Jefferson. More than half a century later, Jefferson's grandson, Thomas Jefferson Randolph, the son of Jefferson's daughter Martha, would declare that the real father of Sally Hemings's children was Jefferson's nephew, Peter Carr, which was said to explain the striking Jefferson resemblance in the Hemings children. Sally Hemings's son Madison would say his mother told him that his father was Jefferson. According to Madison's account, given long afterward, her relationship with Jefferson began in Paris, and she was pregnant with her first child when she returned to Monticello. How the Adamses felt about the calendar accusations would not come to light until much later, and in private correspondence only. Of the two, Adams would have less to say, and unlike Abigail, he did not confront Jefferson with his ire. Considering all that Adams had suffered at the hand of Callender, it would have been quite understandable had he lashed out at Jefferson for his hypocrisy and immorality. Adams could well have gloated over the spectacle of Jefferson under fire, but he did not. It was not until 1810, not until Jefferson